Support comes from WFAE members and Mazda of South Charlotte, incorporating Mazda's customer-centric vehicle design by making the customer the center of business to create a better car buying experience. More at MazdaofSouthCharlotte.com. This is Charlotte Talks. I'm Mike Collins. On the local news roundup, area mayors and Mecklenburg County Commission members call for changes in how CATS is managed and more of a voice in that management. City Council looks again at the problem of public urination and defecation uptown. With the recent property revaluation, your property taxes are likely to go up. But county officials are puzzling as to why more people haven't asked for possible discounts. CMS looks at graduation goals. One area high school experiences a swatting hoax. And the civil rights pioneer, Sarah Stevenson, has died. Here to discuss those stories and more is WFAE education reporter Ann Doss Helms. Shamaria Morrison also reports on education for WCNC-TV. Hunter Sines is a reporter for WSOC-TV. And Eric Spanberg is managing editor of the Charlotte Business Journal. Good morning to you all. Welcome back.
Good morning.
Good morning.
Good morning. Good morning. Problems at CATS over the last year or so have caused a lot of people to question just how the transit system has been managed. And our summer of conversations with area mayors on this program revealed that most of them were unhappy with how much control Charlotte has over the Metropolitan Transit Commission when it comes to decisions. And now some of those mayors, in addition to members of the Mecklenburg County Commission, are calling for change, saying that the city's dominance over CATS is unfair to residents in other parts of the county whose tax dollars help support the system. County Commissioner Lee Altman and the mayors of Cornelius, Davidson, Huntersville, Matthews, Mint Hill, and Pineville sent a letter this week to Charlotte Mayor Vi Lyles. Altman says the group was particularly upset because they felt ignored when Charlotte chose not to follow through on a vote to hire an outside investigator to examine CATS management.
I think a lot of the members of the MTC were really questioning their role. Since, of course, it was the first time in many years that we had sort of developed a different opinion than the city of Charlotte. And on that one occasion, it appeared we were, in some sense, overruled.
So evidently, Charlotte sees the Metropolitan Transit Commission as merely an advisory board, and then they go ahead and do what they want. Is that how they were conceived, Eric?
Well, what's interesting about this, Mike, is no one really seems to be sure as to how this joint governance was going to work. They were certainly not, the MTC was not described as an advisory group. They were described as, I guess, co-leaders, for lack of a better term. And so I think what's happened here, Mike, and Lee Altman's soundbite that you just played alludes to it, is through the first 23, 24 years, they just kind of went along and everybody agreed. And so it wasn't an issue. But then when all of this dissension and controversy erupted at CATS, that's when the fissure appeared. And particularly, I think you may have mentioned the investigation that was voted for. I remember attending that meeting. The MTC voted to hire an outside investigator to look into CATS. Of course, Charlotte Mayor Vi Lyles is the head of the MTC right now. And then a week later, she goes back to council and the council says, no, we'll just have a federal review because it was going to be accelerated and certainly not the same level of scrutiny. And that's what I think led to what happened this week.
Yeah, and there have been lots of troubles at CATS and changes in leadership at CATS. This letter that they wrote also points to a consultant hired by the city who concluded that CATS' current structure, which splits responsibilities between Charlotte City Council and the Transit Commission, quote, creates confusion and a lack of transparency. That echoes, incidentally, what the previous CEO of CATS said when all these troubles began to surface. Mayor Lyles, as you said, is the chair of the Transit Commission. What has been her response to all of this?
It's interesting. Her response was that she agrees with large portions of what was said. Now, she didn't get into specifics. At the same time as this letter appears, we have had several months of talks about forming a regional transit authority, in part to figure out how to secure the funding for a $13.5 billion transit expansion plan that has gone nowhere So, Mike, you have a lot of pieces moving at the same time, but I will say the city leaders, the mayor and Ed Driggs, the councilman who is the head of the Transportation Committee, have so far been fairly conciliatory. We'll see if that lasts. By the way, the MTC met this week. They did not discuss this, but they said they will discuss it at their next meeting in October.
You mentioned there's a lot going on, and there has been a lot going on, at least that we've known about, for about a year and a half. It comes at a time when CATS is going through declining ridership, difficulties in attracting and retaining drivers who have expressed fears over their safety, and the system experienced frequent missed routes and even no routes at all showing up, late routes. They also experienced train derailments, one with passengers on the train, and the discovery that no maintenance had been done on any of the Lynx rail cars for years, meaning that each one of the cars in the fleet has to be shipped to California one by one for repairs. It's going to take several years. It also comes at a time when we're trying to build support for, as you mentioned, transit expansion and for the $13.5 billion transit plan, which includes the Silver Line from Matthews to Belmont. And Charlotte City Council's Ed Driggs, a member of the MTC, would like to find the resolution quickly.
I just hope that we can reach an arrangement soon with the mayors and then get back to the serious work of trying to advance the plan.
So, Hunter, what do they want? The members of the commission who wrote this letter say that they want to make sure that their citizens who are putting in tax dollars through this sales tax are getting a return on their investment. Is that what they want, or do they want more of a say-so in what goes on?
I think it's both. So if you remember, like back when this whole thing was even started, when the commission was formed, it was originally formed during another half-cent sales tax that was asked by all of these towns and their taxpayers. And so it basically was formed to give them the voice on how their own money was being spent. And here we are yet again. I think we've already talked about what led to this and what was the tipping point. But I think it's twofold. I think it's these mayors who are saying, if we're going to play ball with you and you're taking from our taxpayer citizens, we want to say, and we want a vote, really, not only to be seen as an advisory group, which I do large in part think city council members see them as, whether or not that's what it actually is intended to be. I think they want the power to say how this money is going to be spent, since it is directly impacting their communities.
Eric.
Two things that I think that are important, picking up on what Hunter is saying. One is that the current agreement, the MTC agreement, expires next year. So depending on the opinion, this would be a perfect time to take a look. So that's the first part. The second part is Councilman Driggs, while conciliatory in many ways, did make the point that the city of Charlotte is 900,000 people in that taxpaying group, and the six towns in the county are 180,000. And so I think that's where you're going to get to the sticking point. They're willing to do something, but on the Charlotte side, I think you're going to hear a lot of, yeah, but we should have a little bit bigger say because we're much bigger in population.
And when this first surfaced a couple of months ago, I remember one of the people who was unhappy with this situation said they felt that they were like a rubber stamp for Charlotte. Whatever Charlotte wants, Charlotte gets, no matter what the rest of the commission wants. If that were to change, how would CATS change?
That's a great question. I mean, I think one of the things you obviously look at first would be service to the north. You may have heard, Mike, we've had a little bit of consternation from North Mecklenburg about the services they do and do not have. So that would be the first thing to look at. Also, I thought it was interesting that you saw in the letter that they want a much bigger say, or some say, I guess, in the hiring of the next CEO. Brent Cagle has been the interim chief executive since December, following the resignation of John Lewis. And we really don't have a clear path forward on the next CEO. You'll recall that the city manager, Marcus Jones, in essence said, we're calling off the search for a new CEO to give Brent Cagle time to get the house in order. Well, everyone seems to like the job Brent Cagle has done, but certainly he hasn't got the full house in order because he's got all kinds of problems that he inherited and that he is trying to sort through.
We mentioned that one of the complaints, Hunter, among drivers this past summer while they were negotiating the contract with RA TPDEV, I think, was safety. And you wanted to add something to this block, the fact that a CATS bus driver who fought for safety changes is now trying to get her job back. What's the story there? Was she fired?
Yeah, so she was fired. Her name is Gia Lockhart, and we have seen her routinely at some of these rallies, especially after her colleague and friend Ethan Rivera was shot and killed while on the job in Uptown last year. And we have seen multiple rallies encouraging more safety mechanisms to be put in place to keep our bus operators safe. And she feels like this is retaliation for her using her voice and speaking out. There was an incident back in July, she admits, which they put as a safety violation. She didn't go into detail with me just because she is going through the grievance process. She told me that she was fired a couple days later. And ever since then, she has been trying to have these meetings in hopes of either compensation or getting her job back. But she believes that it is an effort to silence her. And she has another colleague who was also fired in July for a safety violation. Now, she admitted she let her bus roll off and she was absolutely guilty of doing that. But she is also a union head, or was a union head, and believes and agrees with her colleague that they are choosing to oust certain individuals who are speaking up against the organization. I will say an important reminder, CATS is not the employer of these bus operators. It's the Transit Management of Charlotte who is. There's a lot of umbrellas here.
Yeah.
But it can be very confusing. But I did reach out to both of them. CATS did not want to comment on it because of that. And Transit Management of Charlotte just kicked me off public property twice. So they wanted nothing to do with the story either. So they didn't refute it. And that's what these bus operators feel, is if we're going to use our voice, then we're getting knocked down.
Speaking of all the confusion and the multiple umbrellas that involve CATS, CATS staffs the Gold Line streetcar, but they don't operate it. It's the city of Charlotte. Is that correct? That's correct.
And meanwhile, that is correct.
Another kerfuffle with that. The stage is being set for one contractor's $115 million lawsuit against the city for work on the streetcar. What is Johnson Brothers, the contractor out of Grapevine, Texas, suing for?
They are suing, in essence, because they say that the city caused the numerous delays. We all remember the fun on the Hawthorne Laden Bridge and how long that was closed. Well, they were the contractor on that and on the overall 2.5 mile extension of the Gold Line. And the city blamed the contractor throughout that process and continues to. The contractor says, no. The city didn't do what they were supposed to do, including, among other things, providing a faulty design that they had to work from that caused delays, not controlling traffic, and many, many more things. And Mike, this has been going on for months in court, started in February. And here's the kicker. It looks like the two sides have agreed on one thing, which is that they can't go to court before March of 2025 because they have so much discovery to do to prepare. So this is not looking like it's going to end soon.
So the contractor says the city is the problem because of interference and incompetence by the city government. The city says the delays were due to Johnson Brothers' failure to provide sufficient manpower throughout the construction, and they blamed them for poor work, saying they had to tear out and rebuild, sometimes more than once, parts of the streetcar route. We have to wait till 2025 to see how this drama unfolds. I'm going to sell tickets to this. This will be on Netflix by then. We have
it's
to take a break.
Teaser, Mike.
Okay, we have to take a break. We're coming back with more in a moment at Charlotte Talks on WFAE. Support comes from WFAE members and Mazda of South Charlotte, focused on applying Mazda's customer-centric approach for vehicle design to car buying and servicing in order to create an experience centered around the customer. More at MazdaofSouthCharlotte.com. It's Charlotte Talks on listener-funded 90.7 WFAE and WFAE.org. I'm Mike Collins. We're talking news of the week on the local news roundup here with Ann Doss Helms, education reporter for WFAE News, Shamaria Morrison, education reporter for WCNC-TV. They're coming along in a moment or two. We've been discussing all things transit with Eric Spanberg from the Charlotte Business Journal and Hunter Sines from Channel 9 WSOC-TV. And we ain't done yet. One of the problems the streetcar and its riders have faced since the Gold Line opened have been delays caused by obstruction of the tracks by cars parking in the right-of-way. And this week, Charlotte City Council Hunter began discussing penalties for that. What are they considering?
Well, right now, it's a cheap $25 ticket if you get caught doing this and parking in some other places as well. But they are talking about increasing those fines to $100 in hopes that it will make people perhaps stick in the line. Especially, we've seen these in Uptown happening in Elizabeth, where cars are parked. I mean, remember eating in Elizabeth and the train just honking until somebody came out and moved this truck because it cannot pass, even if a sliver over the line. If we remember all those tests and measurements when they were rolling this thing out. So they're trying to make sure that they can, of course, be on time without their own staffing issues as it is. So they're hoping that the increase of this fine or potential increase of the fine would help with that.
So some have called that $25 fine, which is what it is now, laughable. And as you said, they want to raise it to $100. And this would not just be for parking and blocking the right-of-way for the streetcar, as I understand it. They would be rolling this out for cars that block bike lanes, correct?
That would block bike lanes. That alliteration there got me. And also all of the semi-trucks that we sometimes see parked right outside or inside neighborhoods, right off of the interstate. We have had so many people complaining about that. The eyesore, of course, that it is. And so it would be penalizing both those drivers and drivers who decide, well, this is a bike lane, let's park in it.
But I've seen driving in on 6th or 7th Street, I've forgotten which, there's some apartment complexes that have entrances to their underground garages and obviously their loading dock for people moving in and out. And that's where the moving trucks have to park. And they park in the bike lane because that's the only option that they have. So what are they supposed to do?
I've heard of complaints about that, actually, of, okay, you're taking away a lane of traffic for a bike lane that some argue isn't used as much yet. And also to your point, I have also seen, like, I believe it's on 6th Street going by Johnson and Wales University, they have put a bike lane, but in the actual, there's still two lanes for cars, and in the right lane for vehicles, they have put parking boxes outside of the bike lane. So yes, it would block, you know, if somebody parks there, it would technically, you'd have to go around into the left lane of traffic, but it does provide a place for parking that's not in the bike lane, and you can do both.
I just want to say, the people who are driving the cars are paying all the road taxes, but we have to give right away to the bike lanes. Okay. Good idea.
No comment.
Thank you very much. Charlotte City Council also spent time again this week on public urination and defecation in Uptown Charlotte. I cannot believe we're talking about this yet again. How rampant is this problem?
So a lot of, go ahead, Eric.
No, go ahead, Hunter. You start. Go ahead.
A lot of residents in different wards, I believe, especially in Fourth Ward community, has believed that this is a growing problem. And it's all because, if you remember, I forget when it was, but a few months, maybe more ago, when we were decriminalizing some of these statutes and city council had to re-vote to implement some, they left this one off the list. And I believe it was quite accidental. And so right now you can be cited for doing that, but you cannot be arrested for it. And some believe that it has gotten worse since then, but you hear people like Braxton Winston who believes the contrary, that that's not the reason people are doing that.
Yeah, residents of Fourth Ward, that's a residential area in Uptown for those people who don't go Uptown very often, have urged the city to reinstate criminal penalties for this. And City Council's Malcolm Graham, whose district contains that area, agrees. To a point.
Obviously, we don't want to criminalize being poor, mm-hmm. right? We don't want to do that. But if we're going to talk about quality of life and our issue, there are some issues that are happening in our Uptown area that I think we need to say that we're going to address those issues specifically that they outline.
But at-large council member, as you mentioned, Braxton Winston says the city needs to look at the root causes of the problem and that the city would be taking a step back to give police arrest powers for public defecation.
I assure you, people are not defecating or urinating in neighborhoods simply because an ordinance is not does not have a criminal prosecution associated with it.
That was on Monday. Council met again on Wednesday to talk about this. Have they reached any conclusions? Guess not.
I don't believe they have at this point. It's still in discussion. And Eric, unless you know otherwise.
No, I don't think they have either. I was going to add that I think it was Steve Harrison on this station who had an interview with Carol Hardison from Crisis Assistance Ministries, and among others, in his story. And I thought it was interesting that she said, you know, she was talking about sort of balancing the humanitarian aspect of this with the quality of life aspect and just really didn't have an answer, talking about how difficult this is to solve because I think, was it Malcolm Graham said, you don't want to criminalize, being poor or having these types of issues going on. But at the same time, you have the whole quality of life. And I can tell you from a business standpoint, people in the corporate community are very concerned about it because you already have the real estate meltdown going on. And once you sort of get that reputation or perception that a downtown is in decline, that is very hard to reverse. And this is certainly a subplot in that. Go ahead, Hunter. I'm sorry.
No, I was just going to say, like, as far as solutions, I know some cities have actually provided public restrooms, and we don't seem to have many in Uptown. Just saying that could be a solution that could be looked at. I know a lot of our homeless neighbors use the public libraries because they can publicly go in there and use the bathroom, but those aren't everywhere, as we know.
And the downtown one is now being torn down.
Correct.
For replacement.
Yep. Meanwhile, council yet again pushed back a decision on creating so-called social districts. These are places where people could go into a restaurant or a bar, have an alcoholic drink, and then take that drink out onto the sidewalk and walk to the next bar or restaurant. Many other cities, much smaller than Charlotte, have had these in place in the Carolinas or in North Carolina for a long time now. We are seemingly kicking that can down the road. What is the holdup here?
I believe after consulting with our government reporter, Joe Bruno, I believe the sentiment is the city wants to take it slow. They knew that there was going to be a lot of interest when you talk about all the neighborhoods that have many breweries all around Charlotte, that there are going to be a lot of applicants for this. When you compare that to, like, let's say Kannapolis, which there aren't going to be many social districts in a town like that. It's just not as big. So I think that's probably why they are taking this extra slow. There are also concerns from some neighborhoods about littering, about, you know, of course, public intoxication and the dangers that could come with that. But eight places or neighborhoods have applied already. Right. And Plaza Midwood could have a hearing as soon as next month on this and could be the first one.
And on Monday, council approved $13.2 million in housing trust fund dollars for six projects and $4.3 million in federal funding for three projects. But there were moments of contention. It was a 7-3 vote. And the three no votes came from Tariq Bakari, Luana Slack-Mayfield, and Victoria Watlington. What was the friction over?
Well, you've heard residents talking a lot about concerns that their neighborhoods do or soon will have too much affordable housing. There are concerns about concentration of poverty, what that does to the value of other housing. These are not sort of novel tensions. This tends to occur frequently in these kinds of discussions, and here we are.
Okay. We're going to let our male voices take a nap for a while and move on to Andos Helms and Shamaria Morrison. Across the state, a troubling trend has developed. False reports of school shootings and other threats are apparently rising. They are false reports, so they are hoaxes. But they are far from harmful, and Ardrakel High School was the target last Friday. Police got the call just before noon.
It was a call of active violence about a subject being inside, armed, dressed in black, with an automatic weapon, shooting everyone.
Major J.D. Thomas of CMPD, again, this was a hoax.
This is a prank call that is matching things that we've seen in surrounding counties and surrounding states.
Again, a hoax, but police still have to respond. So what was the result of that, Shamaria?
A lot of panic ensued and a lot of taxpayer dollars going to this response. I mean, we've been reporting about this as far back as last year, even before this. This is a trend that is happening all across the United States. I remember before the school year started, I spoke to national experts on safety about we're expecting this. This is going to happen. But the question becomes, how do you avoid it if a lot of times it's not even coming from, let's say, within the school or even North Carolina? Sometimes these are calls. Actually, NPR did a really large report on this last year, and these calls had been traced back to, I believe, even the continent of Africa. So it's hard. And you have the FBI involved and all types of folks, but it's a problem.
And for those who say, well, it's a hoax, what difference does it make? It makes a lot of difference. And Jeff Bundy, who works just 2 miles from Ardrakel in Ballantyne, received a text last Friday from his son, a student there, saying that the school was on lockdown, which can be a real event or it could be a practice drill. But Bundy says when his son texted him that they were barricading themselves in classrooms, he hit the road.
I was driving there, you know, a half dozen, maybe, you know, 8 or 10 police cars went screaming past me, sirens blaring. I could see the helicopter coming in and starting to, you know, circle around where I knew the school was.
And he says that the emotional toll that an experience like that takes on a parent really can't be described.
But, you know, I think for a learning environment where kids are carrying that stress and that anxiety constantly, like, it can't be good for their mental health and subsequently can't be good for the future of our country.
So, and CMPD's Major Thomas referred to these incidents happening all over the country. Do we understand why?
Well, and I was able to connect with a State Bureau of Investigation agent after that story ran to find out a little more. They are tracking this. I hadn't even really thought about them. It's called a fusion center. And it has a broad focus on terrorism and crime that disrupts the homeland, but they bring state, federal, and local agencies together. And certainly one of the things that they're focused on is school shootings, which, by the way, you know, they had to respond to this. I think they probably figured out pretty early on that this sounded a lot like reports that were coming in elsewhere around the country. But you can't say, oh, well, let's just assume this is a hoax. Education Week tracks school shootings, and in 2023 so far, there have been 30 school shootings, which have resulted in the deaths of 12 students and 4 adults, 32 people injured. So this stuff happens for real. They had to respond to it, and it's emotionally taxing. It's a huge waste of resources, and you think about all those parents and all those emergency responder vehicles streaming toward a school. There could have been wrecks. Armed police going in. I don't believe anybody has been shot, but this is all very, very dangerous. Yeah, and we don't know if it's people who just are getting their kicks out of it or potentially bad actors that have an agenda.
North Carolina State Superintendent of Education Catherine Truitt spoke about this uptick at a back-to-school safety conference this past summer.
These incidences drain staff and resources and have the ability to spread uncontrollably, usually with social media.
And Anne, you mentioned speaking with a special agent, Brian Neal of the State Bureau of Investigations Center that tracks these school threats. He says there were 398 false threats to schools last year. So you asked him about the source of those threats.
We've been able to show where some of these threats do come from outside the United States. It's just a way of disrupting our society. But a lot of them are in the United States. It's, you know, it's a lot of times it's teenagers just being teenagers.
If they find these people, what happens to them? What are the penalties?
Well, it's a felony. So if they are found, and usually it is juveniles who get caught, so they go through the juvenile system, so we don't know, they are not identified if they are juvenile. We don't know a lot about what happens to them, but this is something that they take very seriously. But I think there are a lot, especially, again, these remote ones, technology makes it easier and easier to bounce off of something and hide your identity.
Well, you mentioned that, Shamaria, and I'm wondering, do they find these perpetrators, or do they just disappear into the ether?
Sometimes they do, sometimes they don't. I mean, I can't remember a case in Kentucky when I used to report there where they found someone who lived like two states away and they prosecuted them to the fullest extent. And you may even be able to find on the FBI's website when they have charged people locally. I believe, you know, they do it. I don't know if it's been at a school, but I remember there was a Charlotte man actually charged with calling in a false bomb threat. I remember seeing it on the FBI's website last year, but I was looking into, do people actually get charged for this when they call in false threats? And they do.
As the Audrey Kell hoax was unfolding last Friday, parents were connecting on a school parent's Facebook page, sharing in real time what their children were texting them, including things that turned out to be false. Karen Fairley with the North Carolina Center for Safe Schools has a better suggestion on what parents should do.
What we suggest that they do is they contact their schools and they contact their local law enforcement, and that they don't take it upon themselves to share it on social media because we don't know if it's credible or not.
Along similar lines, Hunter, yesterday the Mecklenburg County Courthouse was evacuated and later reopened because of a bomb threat. How was that threat transmitted? What did it say? What did it tell authorities?
We don't necessarily know how Mecklenburg County Sheriffs didn't lay out if it was called in or verbally there at the courthouse, but it was a bomb threat. They did go in and sweep all of the floors, as you can imagine, for our court system that is already backlogged. It did not do that any favors. But again, I mean, it shut down that whole area of uptown to traffic in the middle of the day, the lunch hour. And so it just becomes problematic. All these resources going in, but you can't blame them because they have to take everything seriously just in case it is real. But it definitely did not do any favors for all of that staff there.
They did not find an explosive device.
They did
were
not.
There any, you may not know the answer to this question, but were there any trials in progress that might have elicited such a threat?
So there are very few going on right now because of eCourts and Odyssey training. I can't remember the schedule because it is so open closed type of court right now, but I'm sure there were some proceedings going on.
So when we come back, we're going to take a look at why people are not applying for discounts on their property taxes. We'll take a look at the shifting goalposts of educational achievement goals with Shamaria and Ann. And when we come back, a deeper dive into that South Park fire a couple of months ago with David Hodges. It's Charlotte Talks. Support comes from WFAE members and Mazda of South Charlotte, focused on applying Mazda's customer-centric approach for vehicle design to car buying and servicing in order to create an experience centered around the customer. More at MazdaofSouthCharlotte.com. It's Charlotte Talks on WFAE and WFHE. I'm Mike Collins. It's the local news roundup with Ann Doss Helms from WFAE News, Hunter Sines from WSOC-TV, Shamaria Morrison from WCNC-TV, and Eric Spanberg from the Charlotte Business Journal. One of the worst construction fires in the state's history occurred earlier this year at an apartment complex under construction in South Park. The fire completely destroyed the structure, and it took the life of two of the workers, DeMonte Sherrill and Reuben Holmes. WBTV investigative reporter David Hodges produced Fire and Failure, which aired, I believe, last night, David, to look at what happened that day. And he joins us briefly to tell us what he found. Welcome to the program, David. Nice to have
you. Thanks for having me, Mike.
Why did you think that this fire deserved a deeper look?
Well, we tried to start looking into whether these two gentlemen could have been saved. And the more we dived into it, the more we realized that you had to look before the fire even started. And we started getting videos of what happened, security video from the construction site showing that to experts, and really found out there was a lot of safety failures at the site, according to these experts, things that should have been planned for and really were not. And all of those combined led to those two men being unable to evacuate.
Did you know that going in, or did you uncover all that in the course of your investigation?
Along the way, really what we started doing was trying to look into how prevalent this issue of construction fires is. And as we dug more and more into that, we started getting more sources and finding out more information about the South Park fire. And then when we were able to get our hands on a lot of the Charlotte Fire Department's investigative file, that's when we decided to take a deeper dive into what happened there.
You tell the dramatic story of DeMonte Sherrill, who was working with Reuben Holmes, the two gentlemen who lost their lives. They were both installing windows. Since 911 was jammed, they live stream the situation on Facebook with Mr. Holmes standing next to DeMonte Sherrill.
Building on fire, and I can't get out.
It's getting harder and harder for them to see us.
We're going to have to stand out here and ask them to see.
So he's trying to get the attention, from what I can tell from that audio, of other workers on the site. The crane operator did, in fact, try to help and was unsuccessful. And that was the question that you wanted answered. Could they have been saved? And you used that video and others and radio transmissions and 911 calls and fire department records to get the answer. You found, as you mentioned, safety protocols not being followed.
Yeah, and I want to talk about that Facebook Live video for a second, too, because I think a lot of people saw that at the time and thought, you know, why exactly was he going on Facebook Live for this? And I spoke with workers at the scene and also experts. And if you remember from the day, there were public alerts about don't call 911. The system is just absolutely bogged down right now. There was so much sound and the raging fire that these guys weren't even sure if they could be heard from people who were on the ground floor, the firefighters, fellow construction workers. And our experts say that's why they likely went on Facebook Live. And firefighters also tried to reach them. But by the time firefighters got there, the building was so heavily involved in smoke and flames that it was just almost an impossible task for them to be reached. If 911 had been called earlier, if some of this fire had been discovered earlier and the proper steps had been taken, according to our experts, those two gentlemen could have been saved or evacuated from the site.
One of those experts was a man named Raymond O'Brocky, a fire service manager for the American Wood Council. We should mention that this was a frame structure above the parking deck area, so it was going up very quickly because it was wood. And he essentially said that the sequence of events that workers on the site followed was wrong and that they should have been evacuated before the fire department was called.
He should have immediately reported it. He should have immediately evacuated the building. They wasted time trying to, quote unquote, fight the fire with those little extinguishers. Builders are responsible for creating a culture of fire safety. And it really starts from the top down. The problem is that the builders aren't following the code because they don't even know they exist.
Builders aren't following the code because they don't even know it exists. How can that be?
That's exactly what I asked him, and his response was that nobody thinks that they're going to have a fire, or if they have seen a fire, it's something that's small and manageable and that they can handle. And that was originally the response from some of the construction crews that were on scene. They grabbed fire extinguishers. They tried to put out the fire that was on this trailer that had chemicals in it. And his response was that you were just never going to be able to contain this. There definitely needs to be a culture shift, according to these experts, about paying attention to fire code and taking it more seriously. And that's a total team effort from making sure the construction companies have the right safety experts on site and actually have someone who was focused on fire safety, a superintendent of fire safety. And then that also goes to making sure the fire codes are adopted from the international standard and are the strongest standards, and making sure the fire marshal's office, of course, is aware of all the codes and making sure that they're all being followed.
This fire started in a construction trailer that contained spray foam. I'm not sure what that was for, but that's where it started, and nobody was monitoring that trailer. And when they did figure out it was on fire, they brought fire extinguishers before they called anybody. And another expert that you talked to, Joseph Cervantes, told you had there been a fire expert or a monitor looking at that trailer on the scene, and had they followed proper protocols, he had no doubt that these two gentlemen who died in that fire would have gotten out alive. The developer is about to restart construction. What have they said about all of this? And did you uncover anything that fire officials didn't already know?
The developer told us that they're cooperating with state and local authorities as they're investigating the circumstances of this. And they say that they try and implement best safety practices at these sites. Obviously, our expert analysis says that was just not happening at this South Park site. I think what we've really uncovered here by speaking with these experts is that there is just some of the most basic building and fire code issues that are just not being followed on construction sites. And that's not just the South Park construction site, but this is across the city and across the country. One of them challenged us to go to various construction sites and just ask for some of the most basic fire code plans, a pre-fire plan. And I did that, and the fire marshal's office followed up with them a week or so later and shut down that site for not having a pre-fire plan. So it's just a culture issue, according to these experts, that is just not being taken seriously and requires an entire shift. I think the big lesson in this is that it's not just this building. This building just happened to have a fire, and two men pay the ultimate price because of the lack of preparedness.
WBTV's David Hodges, who produced Fire and Failure. It aired last night on WBTV, and I'm assuming that that report is available at WBTV.com, your website, correct?
You are correct.
All right, David, thank you for joining us. I appreciate it.
Thank you, Mike.
Let's go back to school for a moment. The goalposts have been shifting and are likely to shift again when it comes to goals for graduates at CMS. And you report it's long been clear that Charlotte-Mecklenburg Schools has no chance of meeting the school board's goal for having graduates prepared for colleges and careers by 2024. So on Tuesday, the board discussed a possible solution. What was it?
It was, this goal is for 75% of graduates to have state endorsements. And if you don't know what that is, that's part of the problem. But these are recognitions that they have done more than just meet the bare bones graduation requirements that they have. High GPAs, high ACT scores, career tech tracks that will lead them to careers and or language proficiency. And in fact, for the last 2 years, it's been 37% that have had these endorsements. So the proposal that was part of the report that came from Crystal Hill said, we recommend changing our final 2024 goal from 75% to 37%, which kind of sounds like a punchline. I mean, people will make jokes about, you know, the CMS strategy for meeting your goals, but there's actually a pretty complicated and important story in there about how difficult it is, because they really are saying this was not the right measure. The thing we are trying to measure is important. The endorsements don't really turn out to accurately reflect that.
That's what CMS Superintendent Christy Hull kind of said. She started with a previous, she says this all started with a previous school board choosing a deeply flawed data point, her words, to measure an important aspiration, the state diploma endorsement.
I believe what the board was going after, and we all agree on, is are kids ready when they graduate? But the measure of are they ready when they graduate is not a diploma endorsement.
And she says the goal of having 75% of graduates earning state endorsements by 2024 was based on that faulty data, which makes it a meaningless label. She proposes changing that, as you said, to 37% next year. Further, she says, and she is a mother of a senior in school, she says that colleges, they don't care about state endorsements.
Nobody is asking the question, what endorsement are you getting when you graduate? Kids get stickers and they don't know what to do with those stickers.
There's another measure that they are considering adjusting at the school board, Shamaria. There has been a recommendation that by 2029, 97% of students in kindergarten through second grade will score at or above grade level in literacy. Where's that number today?
So they've been discussing it, and to Anne's point about having goals and guardrails that aren't, let's say, mean anything, CMS is reevaluating their goals and their guardrails. They're trying to do it every 5 years or so. And this goal right now, they're in the discussion phase. So right now at the last meeting, they said, maybe let's do 90.9. It could change, but they actually want to hear from the public about what they think about these new goals and guardrails to see where CMS students should be in the next, say, 5 years.
Well, this recommendation that by 2029, 97% of students kindergarten through second scoring at or above grade level in literacy is a goal that CMS board member Melissa Easley is frustrated with.
Absolutely no way we can require our staff to have 97% in anything. We are just setting them up to fail.
So A.J. Crable, a consultant hired by CMS from the Council of the Great City Schools, asked Superintendent Hill what she would recommend to the board.
Hitting the 97% may be possible if you can guarantee that all students would have been with you for the entire amount of time without transition, without. But that's just not the case, which is why a 90.9% goal would be much more reasonable.
90.986549, to be exact. But board member Stephanie Sneed took issue with that.
I'm not willing to have a lesser goal than where we already started, even if we didn't achieve it.
So where does all this stand, Shamaria?
And I should say, Stephanie Sneed was talking about, in general, all the goals. I will say this. If you ever listen to a CMS school board meeting, I recommend listening to the goals meeting because it's a really, really good discussion on what CMS priorities are, but also the real assessment of when you make a goal, is it too aspirational? Because that is a thing, right? Like, let's say 90% of students reaches literacy rate. Is that really feasible though? Like, so are you setting your people up to fail or are you thinking too low? So that's what I will say. It's a very, very complicated issue that can't be kind of talked about in a minute, but it matters.
And they are taking hours and hours and hours. They did a full day retreat. They've done multiple hour sessions. There are still more to come, but it's not sexy. So I think a lot of people don't follow it, but it is very important.
Mecklenburg County went through their mandated property revaluations, and despite both the city and county keeping their tax rates revenue neutral, a lot of people will see their property taxes rise, and that has some in the county puzzled because they say very few people have successfully applied to see if they qualify for discounts on their tax bill, despite what they describe as an aggressive campaign to make people aware of them. What's going on here, Eric?
Well, a couple things. One is they're rolling out a big advertising social media awareness campaign, passing out flyers at public events, because there are two issues. One is that many people simply don't know this program exists, which could provide up to $660 of tax relief for people who earn 80% or less of area median income and with other criteria. So people don't know, or if they know, they don't trust it, Mike. Like they don't think it's too good to be true kind of thing. So they're fighting both those battles. They hope to have 25,000 participants. So far, 1,600.
So this is separate from people taking issue with their tax valuation. This is a special program for people. If it's so important and they're so puzzled, can't they identify who should be on this program and contact them? Can't the county go forward with that, or the city? Quickly.
There is some of that going on. In fact, I think they're about to send out 40,000 postcards to homes that would likely be eligible for this. So they're doing that as well.
Charlotte lost a true pioneer this week, Sarah Stevenson, who helped shape Charlotte schools and our politics for about a half a century, died on Tuesday. Ms. Stevenson went from being a mom with sons going to segregated schools in the 1960s to becoming chair of the school board 30 years later. So, Anne, what can you tell us about her?
She was shaping this community long before most of us were either born or came here. Like you said, she was a product of segregated schools, and her children were products of segregated schools. She led the Black PTA when there was separate PTAs. She helped merge into an integrated PTA and became the leader of the first integrated PTA. She helped shape the plans for busing for desegregation. She was elected to the school board. But what most of us know her for was that she created the Tuesday Morning Breakfast Forum, which is now known as the Sarah Stevenson Tuesday Forum, which brought together people, and it was originally focused on issues for the Black community in Charlotte's West Side. But it became something where, at a time when more and more of us are angry on social media, people came together in person to talk civilly about issues that mattered.
And the current chair of the school board, Elise Dashute, paid tribute to Sarah Stevenson on Tuesday evening at the board meeting there and talked about how Stevenson influenced her.
I would not be who I am today and walking on this path that I'm on without her. So she had an enormous impact on my life with her guidance and her love and how she has modeled how to be a school board member.
And another former school board chair, Arthur Griffin, called her a, quote, fighter for what's right and decent, but also called her a peacemaker who just flat out loved people, Black or white, Republican or Democrat. A rare commodity in this world gone. Sarah Stevenson died on this week at the age of 97. Ann Doss Helms from WFAE News, Shamari Morrison from WCNC-TV, Hunter Sines off on a big trip from WSOC-TV, and Eric Spanberg from the Charlotte Business Journal. Thank you all for the hour.
Celebrating 25 years on the air, Charlotte Talks with Mike Collins is a production of 90.7 WFAE. Support for Charlotte Talks comes from Mazda of South Charlotte. Our executive producer is Wendy Herkey. The senior producers are Gabe Altieri and Sarah D'Elia. Our engineer is Joby Sprinkle. For more information about Charlotte Talks, to listen to past episodes, or subscribe to the podcast, visit wfae.org/charlottetalks. Additional support for WFAE programming comes from the Corporation for Public Broadcasting.
Support comes from WFAE members and Mazda of South Charlotte, using Mazda's customer-centric approach to cars to create a car buying and servicing experience where the customer is the center of their business. More at mazdaofsouthcharlotte.com.